consumerism is our attempt to fill the God-shaped hole that was left when we knocked God to pieces and filled it with this rationalistic economic science. And it's really good. It's a perfect fit because consumerism is exactly what you need. A part of our task is to go back to that challenge, to that deeper underlying challenge of meaning and purpose in the world, and creating the possibilities for human beings everywhere to have that ability to explore the idea of meaningful life and the idea of flourishing.
Welcome to Express Change, a podcast about art and activism.
Right now, we're treating people and the planet like they're here to serve the economy, when really it should be the other way around. What will it take for us to reimagine and remake our economies to deliver social justice on a healthy planet? We're part of a global movement that's trying to do just that.
There's a popular saying, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Our cultural mainstream hardly ever imagines what a different system could look like. We want to find out how new and innovative art can help us change our view on politics, economics, the world, and our fate.
To get to these answers, we'll talk to artists and creatives from a wide range of fields, backgrounds, and parts of the world. I am Marina Gattaz, Culture and Public Policy Lead at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, based in São Paulo, Brazil.
And I am Martin Oetting, an artist and writer based in Berlin, Germany. Thank you so much for listening. This is episode 2 of Express Change. Tim Jackson is an ecological economist and playwright. Since 2016, he has been director of the Center for the Understanding of Sustainable Prosperity, in short, CUSP. CUSP is a multidisciplinary research center which aims to understand the economic, social, and political dimensions of sustainable prosperity. Its guiding vision for prosperity is one in which people everywhere have the capability to flourish as human beings within the ecological and resource constraints of a finite planet. Tim, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We've read this introduction that comes straight from your website, but we'd like to hear from you. How would you describe what is it that you do?
I feel very much in relation to myself as an economist that I'm an accidental economist. The way that I came upon economics was really, yes, as a playwright. And I started out, I would say, I was a playwright before I was an economist, in being interested in the world and being interested in what's going right in the world and what's going wrong in the world and how we might do things better. I very soon, I think, got a clear impression of how important economics was, even though I didn't have a formal economics training at that point in view. You know, through that importance is what led me to thinking about the world in economic terms, thinking about economics as a discipline and becoming, yes, a sort of accidental economist. I think that's probably how I'd describe myself.
But then that almost automatically begs the question, to what extent your storytelling abilities and your storytelling thinking that's been part of you when you found the domain of economics informs the work that you do. Because, of course, if that's the angle from which you approach it, it must inform the way you think.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I think that is true. And I think actually, in a way, it has enabled me to think differently, to not be a conventional economist, to not have a training as a conventional economist. I don't know where the boundaries are. I don't know where the lines are that have been drawn around the discipline. I don't know what the disciplinary feeling is almost. I learn it from the outside in terms of what do I need to know. And I have done. I mean, I say, you know, that I'm not an economist. As an economist, I've been working for 35 years. So I've had a longer training than a lot of people who were brought up studying economics at university. But it's a very odd training because I didn't learn all those first principles. I didn't learn where the guardrails are. I didn't learn what I should believe as an economist. I learned what I needed to know as an economist to solve certain kinds of problems. In that sense, I definitely think differently from someone who was trained in economics. But I agree also that there's some aspects of the way that I approach my task as an economist that it should involve human story. And that's something that, you know, in formal economics goes missing quite a lot. It's a very formal discipline in some ways, and it's full of, you know, complicated formulae and statistical analyses. And I'm not saying that doesn't matter, because I think it does matter. But I think it misses a certain aspect of what economics always was and always should be, which is a moral science, a science about the understanding of ourselves as a society and how we should live well. Playwriting starts from human story. It doesn't do anything to do with statistics or complicated analysis. It's all about human story. So in that sense, I think I brought those two things. One was ignorance, and the other was the capacity to identify a good story.
And how do you feel like today that playwright comes through?
Yeah, in different ways, I think, Maureen. I think, you know, one of the ways is that when I'm in a conference room talking to parliamentarians, I pay a great deal of attention to character. So the playwright is there watching us as characters, including myself, you know, as a playwright in that situation. I'm just a character. My character holds a certain voice for the great playwright in the sky, whoever she or he may be. And I kind of think of myself in that sense, that even what I deliver as an economist, even the part I'm playing in society as a ecological economist, even the part I'm playing as a director of a center looking at sustainable prosperity, I think of that bit of my life as being a character in some kind of bigger drama. And it's a useful position to take, because it means I don't have to worry too much when I get trashed by other mainstream economists telling me I'm talking rubbish, because that would happen in a drama. You know, you'd have to go through that process of the two sides coming against each other and figuring out where the story goes from there. We would both be characters in that drama. So, you know, that's a very useful way to think about your life, as a kind of character in not quite your own story, but somebody else's story, a story of which you are co-authoring with other people. That's one of the ways, I think, in which being a playwright allows me to view myself as an economist differently. And another way has been allowing myself as a playwright to write economics with a slightly different flavor to it. So Post-Growth, for example, which was published a couple of years ago, is much more of the playwright in me than it is the economist, although it has a lot of economics in it. But when I sat down and wrote Prosperity Without Growth, whenever it was, 14, 15 years ago nearly, that was the economist sitting down and writing a text for politicians and parliamentarians and policymakers in a very, very conventional academic think tank kind of way. And one of the things I wanted to do when I sat down to write Post-Growth, which covers very similar material, but covers it in a completely different way, from a different perspective, from a more human story perspective. It's built around the stories of the people whose ideas have been important to me through my life. Approaching it as story, that was a very important part of that task for me. And that, I think, probably wouldn't have happened if I hadn't previously been a playwright. And if I hadn't had that skill, that training, it would have been a different book. And it was very much the book that I wanted to write, having already written a lot of the policy and a lot of the science, a lot of the statistics. I wanted to write a book which was accessible to a broader number of people, that was more based in story, that had a more philosophical feel to it. That was definitely a coming together, I think, of those two roles in my life.
Part of this conversation that we're trying to have over the course of this podcast has also been about coping, you know, coping with the reality of the world that we live in. And I'm wondering, and this is an open question, it might not lead anywhere, but I'm wondering whether this idea that we humbly don't see ourselves as protagonists or the main characters in the stories, but that we see ourselves as supporting characters almost, might be a way of us also coming to terms with the reality that we live in.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea. I mean, we all want to be the hero in our own story. Really, that's, you know, that I think that's a fundamental human drive up to a certain point. You know, there's a desire to cast ourselves in that way. And I think it's important to recognize that desire rather than say, oh, no, I'm working for the good of humanity. That's all I ever care about. And the reason why it's wrong to do that, not that it's wrong to work for the good of humanity, but it's wrong to deceive ourselves that that's all that there is that's going on. So to recognize this role, the role of us, of the I, of the ego, if you like, within the process, is to disempower it. To deny the role of the ego in the process is to lay yourself open to being dragged into, you know, identity politics that just stops you being able to do honest, decent work. But to acknowledge that it's there and yet to allow its power to dissipate in this way by saying, yeah, I am a character in a story, but I'm not necessarily the author and I'm not necessarily the hero. You know, this is actually, it's a liberating place to be in a sense. It allows you a lot more flexibility. Sometimes it'll give you a little bit of frustration because of that desire to be the hero in our own story in which we have control of the narrative. But actually, if you can accept to not be that, then you can do more. I think you can do more. I don't know if I want to say it's honest work, but I think you can do work. I think if you're constantly concerned with being the hero in the story, you actually, I find it, maybe I'm just talking about me, but I find it difficult to understand, to achieve the space within which the work does itself through you. The most impactful things I've done have been when I've been able to step away from ego, step away from expectation, step away from my desire to be seen or to be noticed or to have status or to have success or to have money or recognition, because the work actually is what happens when you're away from all that, when you can step away from it.
And all of us who've seen enough Disney movies know that the small furry sidekick might at the end be the one that hands the hero the key,
right?
You know, yeah, and makes it all happen. So, you know, you can be a very supporting character and still
exactly
help with the breakthrough, yeah, can't you?
There's also, and this is what made me think of that, I think, is that there's also a liberation in saying, and I think particularly within the debates around the well-being economy, it is not the responsibility of one person or two or three people or a small group of people to save the rest of the world. And our sense that we're being driven towards it because of all these awful things that are happening, of course, that's a good drive to be engaged in it, but it can also be very destructive. It can also be a very difficult place to be, and it can drive you into these ego battles and ego blindnesses that don't do anybody really any good, least of all yourself, because it's almost impossible to satisfy. If you start thinking to yourself that, you know, either I publish this book and persuade this government and change this policy and create this impact, or it doesn't happen, then you're not really doing yourself any favors, because that is an impossible burden to carry. And letting go of it, I think, is very useful. And maybe, you know, maybe that is, again, something that comes from this playwright in me that allows me to do that.
You've mentioned before economics not being any more about morality and about how we operate as a society, and a discussion on ethics and who we are, where we're going, and why are we doing things the way that we're doing. And that shift really happened somewhere in the 1900s, yeah, with this push for a mathematization of economics as a discipline, and it stopped being a philosopher's discussion or a political economist discussion. I wanted to ask you, how did societies allow that to happen? But most importantly, like, how do we put morality back into these discussions today when talking about the future of our economies?
Yeah. I mean, why it happened, I think, is really interesting. I think it happened, you know, through the Enlightenment, through the kind of, and then through the Industrial Revolution, when a kind of rationalistic, mechanistic approach seemed to be, have shown itself to be massively successful. And physics, mostly Newtonian physics, also showed itself to be massively successful. And so there was a kind of physics envy going on in the rest of the world. You can see that physics envy happening even in biology, actually, in Darwinism setting itself up as that kind of rationalistic science. Economics then began to get that physics envy as well. And so it also became a more rationalistic science, whereas previously, as you said, it was very it had both moral and political components to it, and it wasn't specifically mathematical, in fact, possibly not even mathematical enough, although it had elements of quantitative analysis going back through time. The moral component became sort of expunged, if you like, through a kind of physics envy. But that coincided, and I find this absolutely fascinating, it coincided really with the demise or the downgrading of religion in secular terms. So religion up to about the middle of the 19th century was incredibly important in secular terms. There was a kind of almost an overlap between state and church, state and religion in Western economies in particular. And that began to be torn apart really mostly by Darwin and by the idea that evolutionary theory brought into our worldview, which was that there's not really any place for God. So yes, go and have your little religion and your way of thinking about the world, but we don't need it. We don't need that to explain the world. We can explain the origins of the world. We can explain the evolution of species. We can explain why we're here. We can explain how important that is. We can do without it. The playwright called George Bernard Shaw once said that religion was knocked to pieces. You know, on the back of that knocking of religion to pieces, that gave way to two things. One was a much more mechanized, rationalistic, analytical science of economics without its real moral components. Or at least that's not quite true, because its moral component is still there, but it's buried in certain assumptions that aren't questioned. They just live inside the economic theory, and all the rationalistic stuff on top is really like a camouflage to stop you getting at the moral assumptions that lie beneath them. So that's, you know, one of the things that happened. And then the other thing that happened was a kind of big gap, what people have called a God-shaped hole, you know, where there was a God that had all been knocked to pieces, and as Shaw says. And then we now have this kind of gaping need for connection and meaning and purpose that doesn't really exist in this highly rationalized economics, but plays itself out through, and this is again very interesting, it plays itself out through consumerism. So consumerism is our attempt to fill the God-shaped hole that was left when we knocked God to pieces and filled it with this rationalistic economic science. And it's really good. It's a perfect fit, because consumerism is exactly what you need in order to make this rationalist science work out for the best. So the, you know, the rationalistic science can tell you production, efficiency, self-interest, that will give you growth, that will give you accumulation of assets, which you invest in more production to give you more growth. And what you need to fit that is a whole bunch of hungry people trying to fill a God-shaped hole in the form of worldly material possessions that will give them instant and continuing everlasting happiness, because it doesn't exist anywhere else anymore. It only exists here in this consumerist vision that you've left for people to explore. I mean, that's my version of why that happened and where it happened and where it left us. And I think the answer to your second question, to some extent, becomes different kinds of questions. One of the questions is, you know, what do you do with the God-shaped hole? If it isn't consumerism, if it isn't this materialistic vision of a kind of everlasting cornucopia of satisfactions, instant gratifications, if it isn't that, then what is it? And how do we create the spaces for that? How do we create the places where we can flourish in non-materialistic ways, where we can feel those consolations that are brought to us by consumerism, by that glittering prize, that vision of never-ending shopping? I mean, it isn't quite shopping. It's more like a kind of search for novelty, for the shiny, for what glitters. And it's a kind of neglect for the deeper underlying heart of what matters. And what we need, of course, you know, what we're trying for is what matters. What we're trying for is this deeper sense of purpose, of consolation for our losses, a sense of meaning for our lives. I mean, it goes right back to the other part of our conversation. It's a part of what we're reaching for when we're reaching for to be the hero in our own story. We're reaching for that same sort of consolation that we were reaching for ultimately previously when we were much more religious societies. But you can't simply say, well, let's wind the clock back on secularization. And so, you know, I think a part of our task is to go back to that challenge, to that deeper underlying challenge of meaning and purpose in the world, and creating the possibilities for human beings everywhere to have that ability to explore the idea of meaningful life and the idea of flourishing, and also to give them access to that idea of consolation. And then the other thing is to teach economics properly. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, we've taught it as this analytic science, rationalistic science, in a very specific way for too long. What I try to do actually with the kids on my classes in the university is actually get them from the beginning of the course to the end of the course as being able to recognize what economics really is, what its underlying values are, what its assumptions are, where it is taking moral positions and whether you agree with those moral positions, so that by the end of the course, you know, what I hope the students can do is to understand not the analytic complexity of economics, but the philosophical underpinnings that economics necessarily has to have, and to be able to engage with those underpinnings. And that's a very pragmatic task. Perhaps a little bit more pragmatic than the first half of it. But I think I see the two things as being equally important.
The other bit that I just wanted to ask, going back to our arts side of the podcast, is art society's way of filling in that God-shaped hole? And what role does it play there in the search of meaning?
Yeah, I think to some extent it is. I don't think that's its only role. I think it plays a number of roles. I mean, I think art brings us back to our humanity. It tells us, it shows us who we are, it shows us who we're not and who we are, it shows us where we go wrong sometimes through tragedy, where we can come right through the hero's journey, if you like. It shows us how to have fun sometimes, because that's also a part of, you know, coming to terms with what the God-shaped hole is, actually, that ultimately it's a very tragic thing. But life itself isn't necessarily tragic, and it has, you know, moments of lightness that matter. And actually, one of the things that lightness does through art is to bring us closer to each other. And that definitely, that consolation of feeling closer to each other and closer to other human beings, plays so many important roles, not the least of which is making us feel better about being here. And going on from that, a sense actually of connecting us to other people, making us more aware of what different people's motivations are, making us understand that the commonalities actually are quite profound, and that we are joined in some way with each other, even though we have lots of differences of opinion, of viewpoint, of understanding, of religious background, and so on. You know, that is to some extent a core role for art and creativity in society, is to keep bringing us back to our common humanity, and to understand through that exploration of our common humanity where difference comes from and where we need to pay attention if we're not to fall into the sort of traps of modernity, the traps of economics, even the traps of apocalypsism, you know, the idea that it's all getting worse and worse. Art's quite good at exploring that, actually. There's a whole trope of, you know, disaster movies and disaster novels and disaster stories talking about how bad it's all going to get. But actually, it's a very good way of exploring through that apocalypsism, if you like, that there is light, there is hope, there is brightness, there is the human spirit. And even actually at the expense sometimes of individual life, there is something that continues and will continue in the sense of that human spirit if we pay attention to it. And I think art's job in bringing our attention to it is really important.
Looking back at 2023, it's just passed. If that year, 2023, was in fact a song or a painting or maybe a book, if it was a movie, what title or name would you give 2023?
I mean, can it be works of art from 2023? I'm thinking of Barbenheimer, I suppose. It was a kind of a year like that. It was a year of putting together sort of pop culture and then these sort of deep, dark threats to humanity. I'd tell you, my favorite film actually of 2023, though, was a film called Naiad, It's a story about a woman who tried, I think it was like something crazy, like 40 years ago, tried to swim from Cuba to the United States. And she failed when she was 23 or something. And then she did it again. She tried it again when she was in her 60s, I think, maybe even in her 70s. And it's just a fantastic view on human resilience and endurance. And yeah, just a sort of insight into the soul in a way that neither Barbie nor Oppenheimer were.
So what would you tell an artist if they told you that they wanted to be part of the solution, but didn't know how?
Well, I think, first of all, just to see themselves as part of the solution. I mean, I think everything we've talked about in a way is that art plays a role that sometimes science just cannot play. So, you know, giving artists permission to see themselves in that way, I think is really important. And then the other thing, which is true of anyone, you know, any project which you're engaging in as an artist, is to immerse yourself in the subject of your piece of art, whatever that art is. I was reading recently about Rodin's sculpture of Balzac, a French writer, and he got this commission. I love it for all sorts of reasons, this story, but he got this commission, you know, to do a statue of Balzac, who at the time was one of the greatest French writers and very celebrated man. And basically, you know, he was supposed to produce this commission in 18 months, but he got so carried away, immersed in the subject, that it was another 7 or 8 years before he actually produced the sculpture. And during that time, he'd gone on this whole journey about Balzac and his writing and his philosophy and what kind of person he was and how he worked, even down to the minutiae of what his day was like writing. And he then embodied all of that in this sculpture. And he took it back to the people who commissioned it. And maybe this is my third lesson for artists. And they basically disowned it and didn't want to have anything to do with it anymore. And so it kind of languished in his back garden until, or his home, in his home somewhere. And it wasn't actually cast in bronze until 20 years or so after after Rodin had died. There's all sorts of messages there for artists. One is, you know, believe you're part of the change. Two is immerse yourself in the subject. And three is don't worry if you get shot at, because that's, you know, part of the game, really.
Thank you for listening. Express Change is supported by the Wellbeing Economy Alliance, the leading collaboration of organizations, alliances, movements, and individuals working to transform the economic system. Find out more at weall.org.
Express Change is produced and edited by Martin Oetting in collaboration with Marina Gattas and the team at the Wellbeing Economy Alliance. You can find out more about my work at martinoetting.com. That's Martin, OETTING.com.